Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Our speaker today is Susan Hagstrom. Susan?
Today I'm sort of doing a synopsis of the book, The Republican Brain, which is kind of amusing because it's a synopsis of a lot of studies that he particularly wrote on this, read on the subject. So you're getting a synopsis of a synopsis of a whole bunch of studies. One caveat, I just had my tooth extracted on Chris Mooney is the author. I just had my tooth extracted on Friday, so if I start mumbling, let me know. Okay, so this book starts with a question that a lot of people have. Why do Republicans think the way they do? And various subsets. Why do they seemingly vote against their best interests? Why do they go out of the way to deny established science, such as global warming, which is a but a serious topic on the author. He's actually written a book called Storm World, Hurricanes, Politics, and the Battle Over Global Warming. So, in the first section of the book, he argues the psychological aspects of the topic. Most psychologists have found out in studies that the fear response is activated in the brain long before the reasoning response. So that the argument is that first you have the emotional response to something and then you use your reason to get good motivation for the reason. So that's based on that. There is the first definition, motivated reasoning. Neuroscientists state that the average human really only knows what is happening in 2% of their brain. Subsequently, the tendency is for the reasoning part of the brain to selectively interpret what belief system is already in place. He references a 1979 study where both pro- and anti-death penalty subjects were provided with fake statements from both positions. And the results did tend to go on the way they'd expect based on the motivated reasoning argument. In extreme cases, he referenced here a study on a case called Mrs. Keach and the Seekers, one of those apocalyptic cults which set a date for the end of the world, and of course it didn't happen, we're all here. They don't get the end of the world, so they translate the world not ending to something else. In this case, the Seekers did such a good job of notifying everybody that was going on that they had saved the world and had to continue their work. What they do is they develop a method where the mind's in conflict. Obviously they're in conflict. If they didn't have the world end, but they had a religion where they said the world would end. So they rearrange the conflict to something that they're more comfortably with emotionally. And they use their reason to do the emotional background for it. So the second definition, he then goes into the five personality traits, which were completely new to me, but some people here might know them. Acronym is OCEAN. Openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. So openness is akin to being experimental, willing to try new things, and then there's the complete opposite, you know, closed-mindedness. Wanting A plus B equals C, et cetera, et cetera. And neuroticism is akin to wanting emotional stability. And further on in the book, there is a considerable discussion on an extreme of this category, authoritarianism. Conscientiousness is the question of being easygoing over efficient. Extroversion is outgoing versus solitary, and agreeableness, well, I mean, that's pretty much what it sounds like here. Fairly agreeable. Interesting that the psychological studies he found and quoted in the book all indicate that liberals are high on openness, while conservatives often rate high on conscientiousness. A humorous study on bedrooms noted that liberals would often have a messier bedroom. So that's the first one I want to read the quote of. Go from the study. They contained a significantly greater number and variety of books including books about travel, ethnic issues, feminism, and music, as well as a greater number and variety of music CDs, including world music, folk music, classical and modern rock, and oldies. Liberal bedrooms also contain a greater number of art supplies, stationery, movie tickets, and a number of items pertaining to travel, including international maps, travel documents, books about travel, and cultural memorabilia. Books definitely qualify for my bedroom. I don't know about yours. Okay. All right. The book then goes on to point out that various studies that argue that Republicans find a need for cognitive closure, that's the actual term. In other words, answer the ambiguity, solve the problem, deny the complexity, the simple path. Which brings us to the next definition. I'm doing this by definitions. They have integrative complexity. I would liken it to my own feeling that if you want to understand a problem, you have to check out as many points of view that you can find, because you never know, you might be missing something. He goes on to, you know, basically say that the person who likes integrative complexity will just wander all over the place and try to find out as much as possible about the stuff. And, well, apparently not a big hit in the conservative arena. To quote, they're not cool with leaving anything fuzzy, unquote. The author, of course, argues that this is sometimes a good thing, that sometimes it is best to set things in what is called a binary system of good guys versus bad guys. And there are situations where you could argue that. Okay, and then the next section of the book has to deal with ethics. So that's another point where they see differences between liberals and Democrats. Oh, conservatives, liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats. He starts out with a discussion with variants on the trolley problem. That's the ethics question that if a trolley or train is coming down the tracks, and throwing one person on the tracks will derail the tracks and save hundreds, what would you do? That's the basic trolley question. So the first study, they set it up so that it was obviously that one of the persons that would be thrown on the tracks was black and one of them was to be thrown on the tracks was white. Conservatives didn't mind. Liberals were very biased towards not throwing the man who was black on this study. Which, you know, as a liberal, made me feel bad. But then the next part of the book says they reoriented the study, and then they substituted nationalities for race. In this case, Iraqis versus American soldiers. And they got the same biased result for conservatives. So there's a ethics 5-point panel. We have these 5-point panels for both ethics and psychology, apparently. This one was created by a social psychologist, Jonathan Haidt. First, protect from harm is one. Number two, a sense of justness and fairness. Three, a sense of loyalty to sacrifice to a group. Four, respect for authority. And five, sense of purity or sanctity. And I expect you could see where this is going. Liberals tended to score higher on the first and the second one, protect from harm and sense of justness and fairness, while conservatives scored on all five. Which means apparently liberals didn't do much for the sense of loyalty to a sacrifice for a group, respect for authority, and sense of purity, while conservatives agreed with those ethics. There are other ethics systems mentioned, but they all tend to amount to the similar results. The ethics system based on families, for example, has the liberals raising the children on sort of an equal basis, and the conservatives with a sort of father top-down authoritarian approach, and the results in the conservatives again going for the points 3 through 5, the loyalty to a group, respect for authority, and sense of purity being much higher than the conservatives. So again, there's a slight difference in how the conservative versus liberal brain works there. And here's where he starts with the hypotheses on why the Republican Party is so anti-science to the point of denying reality. And then another quote I wanted to do. All right, here we go. The core reason for this differential bias turns on the issue of authority and from whence it springs. Okay. The strict father wants the kids to go out and thrive, and producing energy through technology is an honorable way of doing it. However, science can also be an unruly guest at the party, highly destabilizing and threatening to conservative values, and with a potential to undermine traditional sources of authority that conservatives respect. Scientific evidence, quote, has a possible effect over the market, foreign policy, religion, all kinds of things. So they can't have that, says Lakoff, one of the scientists. Okay. All right, now to the actual brains. Don't anybody know the actor Colin Firth? Actor Colin Firth, he starred in Pride and Prejudice miniseries, among other things.
I've heard the name.
Yeah. Well, apparently he's commissioned a study because he was curious to find out why people who disagreed with him, he's a liberal. They did a study of students in England where they did a series of MRIs on the students and demonstrated that a larger amygdala happened on conservatives, whereas a larger amount of gray matter in the anterior cingulated cortex, which is the frontal lobe, which is the thinking matter, happened with liberals. And there's been repeated studies to show that that happens. Unfortunately, the point that we have now is that we have no idea on the scientific world whether this is a chicken and egg routine, whether the bigger, for example, with conservatives, whether the bigger amygdala is because they're conservatives or whether the growth of conservatives in them causes them to grow a bigger amygdala. Backwards and forwards and forwards and backwards. Finally, the author goes into the current denial of science existing in Republicans today. He cross-checked two groups, the Pants on Fire group, and apparently there's another Washington Post group called the Pinocchio group, to see the results. And significantly, the Republicans get more Pants on Fire and Pinocchios than the Democrats. And not only did he do that, he made his assistants sit down and check everything that they checked just to see if everything was right, so they sort of triple check the data there. So they do get, I'm going to point out one of his examples. It is noteworthy and I think sort of demonstrates the problems what the conservative scientists are doing. It involves two scientists that testified at a legislative session in Nebraska. It's a legislative bill to set the abortion date at 20 weeks or less, based on the anti-pain argument. And I could quote this section here. Both Salvation and Grissom, Grissom is a pronounced religious fundamentalist, testified that by 20 weeks of gestation, fetuses have developed the physical structures involved in pain sensation, specialized nerve endings, the brain stem, and the cortex. They therefore inferred that fetuses could likely feel pain at this stage, but that's misleading. What's not fully developed at 20 weeks are the connections between regions of the subcortex, which relay sensory information, and the cortex, which interpret and experience it. And without those connections, as conscious awareness of pain could not exist. So, i.e., he has several more examples of this in the book, they basically, by saying some of the information but not really completing the information. They paint, they've been painting different pictures than what is actual reality, shall we say. So they do deny reality. As you can see, it covers the sense, but it doesn't really cover all the details, so that you get a very inaccurate pictures. And other topics he does is misinformation on economics. You probably heard, any one of you, the misinformation on history that he covers. And just to make sure he does it, he discusses some of the left misinformation things. He includes fracking and nuclear power and anti-vaccinations, which he considers all sort of left things. And so to finish the book, he got together with a political scientist named Everett Young and studied to duplicate some of the findings he was finding in the various studies he did. So in other words, he did his own study. The results politically showed up as accurate. But when they worked on issues that would be called non-political, they didn't get as definitive a result as they would like. So he does conclude that one really needs to do even more studying on the subject. His conclusions, he mentioned a study that where confronting subjects with facts unpleasant to them, the individuals were to write an essay beforehand, before getting confronted with the unpleasant facts. And the essay was supposed to be on something that they really, really, really liked. And they did find that the people that actually wrote the essay beforehand responded more favorably to the unpleasant facts, well, as more favorably as you can, I suppose, than the people who didn't do the essay saying something beforehand. So he does basically suggest, based on that, that if you want to argue with your opposite number, you basically don't go into it in sort of battle formation. I personally know that one time I threw a whole bunch of facts and figures at it. I may have won the argument, but the guy never talked to me again, so I have no idea whether I sort of, shall we say, won the war or something like that. So I don't know how much it feels like that. The author also feels that liberals could start working more like conservatives in terms of organizing better. He has that humorous thing about, I read that humorous thing about the bedrooms, but in terms of social structures, they could do better with that. And between the way the anti-scientist people are sort of misusing science, fact-checking, he nags his fellow journalists to be better at fact-checking. One other example in the book he had that was a serious fact-checker error was apparently Jon Stewart went on Fox News and called them a bunch of liars, pointing out the PolitiFact fact-checkers as a source. And the political fact-checkers really didn't pay much attention to their own data, said that Jon Stewart was wrong, and Jon Stewart apologized. So the author sort of points out that now, instead of one group being wrong, three groups were wrong, which really doesn't help anything. So then I'll also point out two of his other points. Three of his other points. Okay, let us see. Liberals and conservatives are different in ways that can be measured and really matter. This has everything to do with our divide over reality and the facts, where it helps to explain why liberals tend to be right. And three, accepting this reality has a monumental implications for how we conduct political debates, and indeed for the future of our perilously divided country. This author also wrote the book The Republican War on Science, so he is an individual who really doesn't like what Republicans have been doing to science on the political debate.
So you read that book also, The Republican War on Science?
Oh, yes.
I watched the hour up until the question and answer period of his presentation on the most recent book to the Freethinkers Arizona. And he said the findings in his earlier book, he didn't say were wrong, but he felt now that it wasn't the whole picture. So his new book is looking at the new research since then and filling in some gaps.
Yeah, this is sort of a continuation of the Republican War on Science. The Republican War on Sky was basically a history of how science has been going, well, wrong on the Republican side of the aisle. And it's pretty much, it started with Newt Gingrich and basically dismantling any programs that advise politicians on the federal level, at least. I suspect a lot on the state level as well. So any groups that really advise politicians on the rights and wrongs of science was basically thrown out, and politicians now can jerry pick whoever they like. And if you read this book on the psychological aspects and going for emotional, then figuring out your motivated reason for it, they pick some pretty shady customers, like that anti-abortion thing I read you, where they gave you half the data, you get a different picture than you have the rest of the data. So they do all sorts of things. He also has things with the global warming where that happens. And for him, the motivated reasoning plus the sort of closed-minded authoritarianism provides a good deal of argument as to why they are going that way. A good portion of the book discusses the sort of history of Phyllis Schlafly, who he equates with really helping to kill the ERA amendment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it pretty much goes on, they have a pretty good, based on what he wrote in this book, they have a good, pretty good picture of how she pretty much almost manipulated groups using, among other things, fear and the sort of closed-mindedness and the wanting this picture of America, and how she basically manipulated these groups into helping her kill the thing. And then he also goes to point out that while she was doing this, she went and got her PhD at, was it Harvard? Yeah, so I think he puts that in just pretty much to make sure that these sort of liberals who think these people who go in for these ideas are stupid idiots who don't know what they're talking about. No, a lot of these conservatives who pull these stunts have serious degrees.
How did the gentleman figure out someone, I'm a liberal or I'm a conservative? Did he ask the subjects, are you liberal, and they said yes or no, or did the definition that he put people into these definitions?
No, apparently with these studies, and there's several different ones, authors he quotes are Jonathan Haidt, a guy named Lakoff, and a few other ones. But apparently with a lot of these studies, what you do is you put in a questionnaire with indicators that would say this person is a liberal and this person is a conservative. You don't ask outright. Mm-hmm. Because if you do ask outright, this book was written in 2013, and that was still at the period where nationally, politically, if you called yourself a liberal, that was some sort of equivalent to calling yourself a dirty name. So
they asked, a subject would sign up and they fill out a questionnaire, and then he would put them in a category based on the questionnaire?
Yeah. So the terminology has always been a pet issue of mine, and I think with studies you have to be very careful with that, otherwise people will judge themselves one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions about the scientific methods applied. To the obviously a lot of research, and therefore there's not going to be a single answer. One is, how much of the research that's quoted have been double blind, where the person administering the brain part of the study doesn't know the results of the political part of the study?
Oh, as I said, this was sort of a synopsis of a bunch of studies he wrote, so you'd have to look up at the actual study.
Yeah.
Considering that it was done by an actor, I wouldn't be surprised if it's out on the web.
Yeah. And then the other question is, if you were to study someone not knowing their politics, and study the brain part of it, could you predict their politics, and what would be the level of reliability of that prediction?
That's a very good question. Can you go backwards with
this? Can you go backwards from these results?
Well, he has a small paragraph. I don't know how much I personally swallowed it, but he did have a small paragraph in there that sort of looked at old MRIs of people in various well-defined red states versus blue states, and noticed that the tendency on the old MRIs, ones that they didn't take, they just, you know, got the permission to look at the old MRIs in a bunch of red states versus blue states during elections, and to found that it did fairly prognosticate fairly well.
Okay,
still curious. So it's not individual, you couldn't say individually, but in terms of a huge sort of group of potential people.
A third scientific method question. Are the results of any of the brain scans more or less predictive than the results of simply knowing what the religion was of the person's parents?
Didn't discuss the religion of the parents, so I couldn't answer that question. You'd have to go into the studies. He's talking politics. Some of the religious politics does flow into each other, like with the anti-abortion thing. At least one of the scientists was clearly a religious fundamental, and he says so in the book. The guy described himself as a religious fundamental. Answering questions to meet his makers, I think is how the guy phrased it. Not eat his maker, please his maker. But it's only incidentally. He does sort of semi tie in with his chapter on authoritarian, well, not chapter, paragraphs on authoritarianism. He does sort of tie in the religious aspect of authoritarianism behavior in parental types and stuff like that. But he does not go deeply into religion in this book.
How much does he get into the question of nature versus nurture? Like the environment that you grow up in, how much does that influence you and heredity?
Yeah, that was one of the, I mean, that's the chicken and the egg thing with the brain scans, MRI thing, because you really couldn't know unless you have a great deal more studies. And I don't even know how you phrase those studies so you can figure it out.
Yeah, and education level, or a whole series of potential other
You don't go into education level a little bit, but mainly to make sure that any liberal or Democrat reading this book ceases to have the idea that the people who there's a stereotype there among liberals, I occasionally have it myself, I admit it, that anybody who votes conservative these days doesn't have a brain cell in their head. And he mainly uses the education level, at least the way I was reading the book, to basically show that, no, he does talk about it. Oftentimes, people who even use the motivated reasoning are among the most sophisticatedly educated people.
Well, some of the smartest people I know are my fundamentalist cousins.
Yeah. So,
But
he says,
not science smart.
No, well, yeah, they wouldn't go
into
science.
They don't study science.
On the other hand, this openness to experiment, etc., he says, has moved the situation so that academia is growing more and more to the point where it will vote Democrat in the last 40 or 50 years, which is probably why you see more and more cases of Republicans attacking academia as liberal havens and stuff like that. But it's probably, he thinks it's more psychological for the education thing, that these academias are sort of protecting themselves more than anything else.
I think for an aspect of this that intrigues me is your the comment about the end of the world folks is that they, we have a view of the world for whatever reason, nature and nurture. And generally speaking, most people, whatever facts come in, they deal with those facts as long to reinforce their world view. To be experimental, like you were saying, obviously I think it's very risky. I mean, the world of academia, you're in an environment where you're encouraged to think outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, all of us want to not think out of the box, because if we do that, then that kind of unsettles our way of living. It's, oh my God, this is contrary to my worldview. What do? Do I think about it, read more about it, talk more about it, or do I just kind of encapsulate it and make sure it reinforces my worldview? I think that's the real issue for me, is how do you encourage situations where people want to be experimental, want to look at the facts and try to make the world a more intriguing, better place by having those facts as part of the discussion, rather than encapsulating and saying, no, I'm going to discount it because it challenges my worldview. So anyway.
Yeah, and it does create a big sort of stumbling block when you really try to argue against the other side.
Right.
You could quote all the be nice and everything else. Mike McCabe has been trying to get conservatives and Democrats to talk to each other in Wisconsin for quite a while.
Yep.
I still remember his phrasing that totally freaked me out, which is, if you want to talk to Republicans, remember they appreciate values over facts, and we'll throw out the facts if you want to.
Yeah, good point.
For the values, and that made me totally uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Totally uncomfortable.
Yeah.
One of the things Mooney points out is that liberals have a much greater tolerance of ambiguity, and conservatives want closure. They want to have the answers set down, and once they've got the answer, they want to hang on to it.
That's good. That's what I was trying to say. And why people do that? What makes them more open to thoughts? That's, I think, the key. And as you very well eloquently pointed out, is you could cite chapter and verse of facts, and they forget it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't win.
Does he have the graph in the book that he used in his talk in Arizona, where he shows the education values, the liberals are above the line and the conservatives are below? He has a blue section and a red section.
No, I don't think so.
I thought that was pretty informative. He shows evaluations on the basis of how much value people put on education, on openness and conscientiousness, and a couple other things.
No, most of this was all writing on this book. Let's see if I can... 12.
He may well have developed that after he published the book to...
Oh, yeah.
...go on his tour.
Yeah, with those tours, you just have some, you need pictures more. At least people think you need pictures more. I'm not a huge fan of... slide presentations. Okay. Yeah, it was a University College of London students for that MRI thing that he quoted in this book. So you could probably type in Colin Firth and University College of Student MRI test and see if there's a result online. Sort of willing to bet.
NPR, I think it was NPR, was talking about why the Democrats did so well, and they were talking about one factor was suburbs now are changing from conservative to liberal and voting Democratic. And they were saying, well, the highly educated suburbs, and so I'm just saying that's an interesting fact, that they were somehow saying, well, the suburbs are now more educated, therefore that's why they're voting Democrat and liberal. And I'm just throwing that into the mix of what we're talking about today.
You gotta take that stuff with a grain of salt,
my
opinion.
Thanks to you, I'm taking that comment with a grain of salt.
One other thing that got me in this book is it is noted that in terms of the election of the Democrats that came up, is that Tammy Baldwin's approach got the most non-liberal having votes of all the Democrats. You could read a whole article on it in the Center of Media and Democracy, I think, wrote a whole argument on it. But in terms of getting the most votes from centrist and not-so-left Republicans, Tammy Baldwin was the one who got it. And they detail her approach. And one of the aspects that fits in with this thing is that the majority of her ads were really not that combative. Mm-hmm. And she went in for the personal stretch. Mm-hmm. So I saw one of the ads. There were more out there apparently, but she would, for example, with the opiate addiction hot topic apparently in upper Wisconsin, she went into the fact that her mother was a sufferer of opiate problems.
Right.
And it sort of goes under, you know, the personal touch, trying to get in touch with your people, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this article in Center for Media and Democracy sort of feels that that personal touch was what got her significantly more votes than that Leah Buechner, that was the person she was running against.
Yeah.
Who, have you ever noticed any of her ads were extremely combative?
Oh, yeah.
She got a few pants on fires, I think, too, in terms of what she said about Tammy Baldwin, or the equivalent and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it argues into what this book is sort of saying, is that if you want to approach the other side, you have to, you know, really approach them, not fisticuff.
Right. Chit-chat about their life and the beer that they're drinking, and eventually you might talk about those issues, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, this book has been rather helpful for me. Al there, I'd probably want to go into some of the studies. And some of them are, you know, kind of iffish. He quotes the MRI, but that sort of thing. But the other examples he talks about the economy, and that still is fairly new to me. On
the study population was 90 students.
Yeah, not huge.
Yeah.
He does say 90 in the book too.
Mean age 23.5.
Yep, with students.
4.84 standard deviation.
Mm-hmm.
But I get sometimes, even though, last night I had the privilege of seeing a movie, Untouchables, about sex offending. I thought it was a very balanced presentation. There's pros and cons back and forth all the whole through the hour and three quarters. I didn't think it was a polemic at all. But anyway, there's one gentleman that they talked about, Richard Book, who's a very influential developer, legislator, I don't know if he's a legislator, but he's a lobbyist. And his work, his daughter was sexually abused by a nanny that he hired. So he has been, since that time, since the daughter came out with this, he's been on this vendetta of anybody considered a sexual offender is dirt, basically. And he's been influenced with legislation a lot. And so, of course, they interviewed him throughout the film. And there was some information that the interviewer would present to him that challenged his view that sex offenders are dirt. Apparently, 97%, it's a very complicated subject, obviously, but one statistic is 97% of the people who are committed, who have been charged with being a sexual offender, go back for technical reasons. Not for doing sexual offenses again, but, you know, being late for a curfew and probation officers get angry for breaching a technicality. So, that most next sex offenders are not these dirt bags that he wants to describe. But anyway, So he would get this information. He'd see the original research. The interviewer would present, this is the original research, which challenges your view. He said, that's bullshit. I'm going to continue to do what I was doing. So that's
doesn't
really...
doesn't sound like a person worth arguing with.
Well, the issue is he's a very influential. He's gotten major legislation in Florida. Yeah. There's, I think Florida, they were talking about many situations in Florida and Oklahoma. And I'm not sure if it's Florida or Oklahoma, but they passed legislation in one of those states that if you've been committed a sex, if you have been arrested for being a sexual offender, you cannot go to a public park in the state of Oklahoma or state of Florida. I don't know what state it was, but I mean
that's Oklahoma.
Was Oklahoma? Okay, yeah. Yeah, so anyway, that's to me, that's the discouraging part is you present information, original research, and he says, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
And again, to create
his... Don't trouble me with that.
Yes, that's right, exactly right. I have this worldview and forget it. So anyway, I thought that was disconcerting.
Yeah, I do have issues from working at Mendota Mental Health Institute when they instituted the sexual predator law. On that topic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you're really never off of probation in Wisconsin.
No, so you're on the registry for life.
Yeah.
And there's some states who give you less than life, but there are, I think Oklahoma, one woman they interviewed, I think, yeah, she's on the registry for life.
Forever. And she was the offender as a teenager.
Right. It was some, yeah, she
was... some underage 14-year-old,
right.
And they were both teenagers, and... the boy's mother.
Yeah.
Pursued.
Oh yeah, you're very aware of that. Yeah,
oh yeah.
Exactly.
Then she went on to have two little children that she'd take to the park.
Can't do it.
And then she can't do it. And
yeah.
They're talking about taking away her children.
Well, that's what you were there last night. I
was.
Okay, now I know.
And one of the things about this book guy, at the very end of the documentary, the person who was interviewing him said, well, you've introduced all of these bills about keeping sexual predators off the streets and everything, and he's really proud of himself. He said, but in your daughter's case, would any of these laws that have been passed prevented your daughter's attacker from doing what she did? And he sat back and said, no. None of these laws would have been effective in preventing what had happened to his daughter.
I mean, the first problem with sexual abuse is that it is, you could compare it with nuclear power. You can swear up and down the Bible that nuclear power and waste is safe in containers, but nobody wants them in their backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Same with anybody who's been accused of any sexual abuse, pedophilia or regular sex abuse and stuff like that, when the vast majority is not snatch the kid off the street type sexual,
yeah.
At least when I was working at Mendota.
Oh, yeah.
The huge majority was more like this case of the guy who hired a nanny and got abused that way. Same with, you know, the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that legislating about sexual abuse is a reflection of a long-term tendency in our culture that we don't mind violence, what we mind is sex. And so even when it's sexual violence, it's not necessarily the violence, because there's plenty of that all around the place, but it's the sex.
Conservative nature, huh?
Well, I don't know. I'm asking a question. But in my lifetime, that seems to be pretty consistently true. People go to movies that have all kinds of violence in them.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatives, liberals, Republicans, Democrats, they go to movies that have violence in them.
Mm-hmm.
But show some private part of somebody's body, and it's like,
yeah.
Big deal.
I agree. We're very conflicted about our sexuality. I help out with the OWL program at Prairie. It's a sexuality education. I'm sure to you it's called OWL, is a sexuality education program, and that's the big point of what we do. We just talk about it, and we try to make it very matter of fact. And it's important to talk about the pluses and the minuses and the confusions, but you talk about them. And I think that's what you're saying, is we're not honest, I think, about being sexual beings. And we can't say we have these fantasies, we have these thoughts, these desires, and we act, some of them, unfortunately, are inappropriate, but all of us have sexual desires. And to admit that and to talk about it is very difficult. So, and that's what Al tries to do, is undercut that. No, you got to talk about it because you got to have appropriate, respectful behavior. I think you're talking to my point. Yeah.
I don't think we have laws like the sexual abuse laws for simple abuse. Children are punished in abusive ways, not sexual ways, but abusive ways. Well, where are the laws for that?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you have a sexual violence, the sex part sort of ratchets up the horror for people.
That's what I'm suggesting.
You're right.
Remember slowly converting a Lutheran to the point where she would admit there was at least some question of the existence of God. And one of the points that was rather interesting is that I was not religious at all. And because I firmly believe in the you're innocent until proven guilty, plus the you're always supposed to be given a second chance, I had the unpleasant situation of defending pedophiles, and she was knocked the door and throw away the key because she was a parent. And most parents, you know, even the thought of having anybody remotely susceptible to that sort of behavior. But I am, you know, really of that opinion, and working at Mendota, sort of, yes, there were some cases which should be very closely monitored at all times, but I still think they should be given a second chance, even if it's very closely monitored. So it was a unique situation where the person who was supposed to be, Christian and conservative and stuff like that was going for a more hardline case than I was. I thought I would bring the most Christian and forgiving and stuff. And it was just like, okay, that's sort of weird. But yeah, no, there are button topics, and, you know, he points it out in his book too, sure, that hit people, you know, the left, nuclear power, you talk to one of these anti-vaccination people, they're almost always more liberal types. Even with the fracking notion, he does present some arguments why it's not that bad an idea. I don't agree with him with that one, but it's also a sort of hot-button topic, so yeah. you really get left people riled up on the topic.
You did mention the fact that our emotions kick in first and then the reasoning kicks in second, right? You made that point.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's, you're speaking again to that point, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in this town, I mean, yeah, it's true, it's American, you don't see it nearly as much in, well, say, France. But any topic with sex on it, it's like, phew.
But again, it's all over the popular culture, you can't get away from it. It's in the ads for automobiles and...
Yeah, what car am I buying today, right? I know.
Yeah, but... If you have the right car, you might get your goal with sexual.
Yeah.
Oh, if you think that was bad, I remember this fast food commercial where it had, you know, one of those hot rod sexy cars and this lady dressed in pretty much nothing but strips eating this huge burger. And you couldn't help but saying, yeah, right, anybody who was that thin would not be eating this huge burger. No! Not even outside dressed in nothing but strips.
Yeah, the questions about the writing of Chris Mooney.
Yeah, I would totally recommend him, particularly if you do get like I do, which is sort of, why are they doing that? Behavior when it comes to your Republicans, the way you wish they would stop voting like that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes, indeed.
And if nothing else, I'll give you glimpses into more studies you should be looking at.